I mean, I'm not an expert. I just have, I don't know, it's just sort of something grown with years and an interest in the saying. And going over the years just with Julien and groups to Spain and visiting places he lived, the churches he built, the people he talked to, the smelling the air he smelt in the morning and in the night. I think all these things, as he becomes more and more a guide for me. He's a friend, really. Julien said earlier about spiritual friends. He's a spiritual friend. He's also an extremely gifted man. And he's a gifted in writing on the spiritual life. He was also gifted in the pastoral life. I should say a little bit about myself. I work in a place called St. Mary's University College, where Mary works with colleagues together. And my job there is to teach pastoral theology, which you may think is to do with sheep and fields and playing panpipes and things. It's a funny subject in a way, because we have what we call, the medievals talked about two sorts of theology. They talked about the theology of the head. Yeah. What they call it, the theologia speculativa, speculative theology. So if you go and do a degree in theology, an undergraduate degree at St. Mary's or Heathrow or Manchester or Edinburgh or Oxford, basically what you are learning is the speculative theology. It's the theology of the head. It's very, very important. You know, I don't knock it. I teach on these programs and it's very important. However, for the medievals, that was only half the story. And in fact, in a medieval university, shortly, we look at the medieval University of Spain, Salamanca, Alcala, where John was. In the medieval university, you couldn't study the speculative theology without also studying the theology of the heart. They called it theologia mystica, which you can translate, if you like, as the mystical theology. One of the first translations in English is by the anonymous author of The Cloud of Unknowing. And he gives it a rather, we assume it's a he, he gives it a rather lovely translation. He calls it the hid divinity. That's his translation of theology, the hid divinity. And I think that's a lovely way of summarising. So pastoral theology, what I teach at St. Mary's, is more the hid divinity, as much the hid divinity as it is the speculative divinity proper. And immediately you will say to yourself, well, how the hell do you learn that? How the hell do you teach it? You know, the hid divinity. Because the other thing to say, it's turning into a theology lecture, the other thing to say about theology is it's a very unusual subject. It's not like geology or sociology, criminology or whatever. With these particular subjects, you have a subject that you examine. The geology, you can go down to the Lyme Regis and chip away at the rocks and look at the rocks and look at those wonderful strata of Lyme Regis and work out, you know, what year they were laid down, which fossil is in where, so on and so forth. The object of the study, the object in inverted commas of the study of theology is God. Now, we can't get on a train to Lyme Regis and go and look at God. You know, we just can't do it. We can't put God on a microscope slide. We can't examine God by definition. So, in the faculties of the university, which is where I've spent a lot of my life, the faculty of theology is a rather odd faculty. It's odd people, anyway, as Mary will tell you. I mean, really, the oddest people in the university. But part of our... St. Mary's University... Well, have a chat with Mary after. So Mary will tell you all about it. It's a Catholic... yeah, Mary... They will give you a history. It was found, very briefly, it was found in the mid-19th century to train Catholic teachers, and it's grown from there now, and now it's a little bit, but that's another story. So we're old people, and theology is an old subject. So there's an oddity there, there's a strangeness, and that little word, hid, mystical sounds a bit pompsy, doesn't it? Hid is more Anglo-Saxon, more graspable, which is what we like, Anglo-Saxon. So that the hiddenness, the oddness, the obscurity, the other key word you see in the medievals is obscurity, obscuridad in Spanish. And it's a key word for John. John was a master of the hid theology. He studied it, unlike Teresa. A lot of you would have heard G.D.M.'s lecture. Teresa had no formal education in that sense. She was an extremely bright woman, very, very bright woman, but she had no formal education. John did. So John went through this theologization. But the word oscura is a key word for John. And in fact, I suppose his most famous poem, what we call in English The Dark Night, begins En una noche oscura. On a dark night. En una noche oscura. Con ansias en amores inflamada. Fired with love's urgent longing. And then we have that second trope, symbol for John. So you've got scura, darkness, and then con ansias in amores inflamada, inflamed. I suppose his other great poem that we know of is The Living Flame of Love, we translate in English. As fire and light. Fire at midnight. What's going on, and it's a contradiction, isn't it? Fire at midnight, an odd thing, and we're immediately launched in the first two lines of that poem into a strange world, because the masters of this theology, and by masters I mean men and women, knew, and I include Teresa in that category, knew that when we approach this type of theology, when we approach God, our normal categories have to collapse a bit. Unlike looking at our rocks, or our criminals, or our animals, whatever it is we want to look at, when we look at God, we're going into a different space. We're going into a reflexive space where the poem, or the writing, or the theology, reads us as much as we read it. I gave a talk a few weeks ago to a group. I was wondering whether to share this with you, but I will share it. And this is a warning. At the end of the talk, this fellow said, and I could see him more and more upset as the talk went on, because I was not giving him what he wanted. And unfortunately, when that happens, I give it even less. And he said, at the end, he said, but what is the correct interpretation of John's poem? What is the right interpretation? And I said, well, there isn't one. I'm not happy with that. You know, there had to be a right interpretation. And unfortunately, it's like one of those arguments where afterwards, at the time, you can't think of the right word, you know. Someone shoved you in the face with an umbrella on the tube, and you can't think of a witty little response. But I couldn't think of a witty response. And I knew somewhere that John had said this, but I couldn't remember where. And funnily enough, when I was preparing for today, I did actually find the passage, so it was sort of confirmed that it was there. But what I'll do, actually, I'll save that till afterwards. I'll save that till I look at the poetry. So, obscurity, paradox, very important both for Teresa and for John. Remember Teresa at the beginning of the interior cabinet. It's very difficult to give a lecture on John without bringing in Christmas. They were so intermeshed. Teresa at the beginning of the interior castle, within the first paragraph, gives us seven images of the soul. And they're not completely different, but they're all sort of pouncing on that. The soul is like a dungeon, the soul is like a castle, the soul is like a paradise, the soul is this, the soul is that, the soul is God. She gives us all that. The whole of the interior castle is in the first paragraph of it. She also knows that when you talk about the spiritual life, you can't use, if you like, linear speech. It's not a phone directory. Interior castle, the poetry of John Scott, they're not phone directories. You can't say, ah, yes, okay, yeah. Paragraph 6.31, yeah, that's the consolation I had yesterday. It's not how it works. There's an oddness, there's a strangeness. God is odd. Terry Hughes, the Jesuit, calls his book The God of Surprises. Yeah? And I think we have to remember that. He also says another key phrase in Dark Night of the Soul, if I can find it. Amado con amada, amada en el amado transformada. The lover with the beloved, transforming the beloved into the lover. Absolutely key to John. Amado con amada, amada en el amado transformada. Transformada, transformation. Absolutely vital to John. This sense of movement. Again, when we look at poetry later, there's always movement. And this is the wonderful thing about it. You can't pin it down. Like Teresa's interior castle, you can't pin it down. You can't turn it into a telephone directory. And they deliberately do that. They deliberately do that. I mean, when we look at how stuff was written, both of them, Teresa and John, acknowledge that some of it was conscious, but a lot of it was what we call unconscious. One of the sisters, towards the end of his life, asked him how he gets the inspiration for the poem. He said, some of it I caught, but a lot of it came to me. Some of it he grabs, as it were, with a conscious mind, but a lot of it comes to him unconsciously. So it's transformational, it's paradoxical, and also it uses symbol. Same with Teresa. Symbol is from the Greek. It means bringing together. We're in this symbolic place. And those of you who are interested in Jung, as Julien is, we know that Jung, in a time of crisis, time of unknowing, time of oldness, the symbol emerges spontaneously, growing together. Jung famously had a breakdown during the First World War, famously had the symbol of the mandala, M-A-N-D-A-L-A, Sanskrit word meaning the circle. He says at times of psychic disintegration, the symbol arises. And as we'll see in a moment, for John, the time of greatest psychic disintegration, the symbol of the poetry came to him. That's when, at the time of the greatest disintegration in his life, that's when his career as a poet began. Of course, the opposite of symbol is diabolic. The diabolic is that which scatters, pushes away and apart. So symbol, night, fire, flowers, stag, you heard some earlier, the stag, Teresa, the lizards, the castle, the butterfly, the water. Symbol is an extremely important instrument for these masters of the head divinity. Because they know that if the symbol carries us often from the conscious to the unconscious, and from the unconscious to the conscious, the symbol can hold both the conscious and the unconscious. So we find both of them using an awful lot of symbology. John uses an awful lot. Does that make sense, what I've said? Yeah? Yeah, please do. As long as you don't ask for the correct interpretation. Yes, what would you like me to expand on?
I did not say just for these masters of part of the... I'm not forgetting this direction, but it's going to be part of the problem, that is the symbol of the problem.
Yes.
Yeah, the transformation.
Yes, the symbol... For, this is from Jung, basically. Are you familiar with the works of Jung? No. Carl Jung is a Swiss psychologist, and... He, in midlife, about 35, 40 or so, he had a mental breakdown. Yeah? Everything he'd been working towards fell apart. He lost or he resigned his job. He had a big buster with his colleague, Freud, and everything seemed to be falling apart. In this time of disintegration, what happened for him were these images spontaneously emerged for him. He called them mandalas, which means circle. And he would draw, I'm sure Julian's got pictures somewhere in the flat. The mandala, this is a mandala. You see this circle, the castle, and it holds. And he creates a structure, a holding structure, within which transformation can occur. It's a safe structure. I'll give you another example of a mandala from my own life. In a time of disintegration, chaos in my own life, I had a dream. And in the dream I was in this crowded room with all these people. There was a lot of noise and chaos. And then, in the middle of this room, came a red-haired lady. My therapist at the time was Irish, so probably the Irish matron, mother coming out. Anyway, the red-haired woman came into the middle with four men and four women. She cleared a space in the middle of the room, and then the four men and the four women started this beautiful dance, sort of elegant, like century. And as they danced, the crowd started to calm down. They started to sit down and they started to watch the dance. And eventually, everyone was sitting down, in like you are now, in attentiveness while this dance finished. That's a classic mandala dream. The chaos of the psyche, a order comes through, in this case, a fourfold structure, which was perfectly balanced, male and female. And by the mandala coming in, by the order coming in, it calms down the chaos in the psyche. Jung thereafter, before he saw his client, I think for quite a long time in his life, would go down to the beach in Zurich, Lake Zurich, and he would play with the sand and the stones, and he would make these mandala shapes for an hour after lunch. Even as an old man, I think he did that, didn't he? He would go down for an hour after lunch and make these mandalas. I was on the Isle of Iona in September, which was fantastic, and as part of the exercise for the group, we all went down to the beach and made our mandalas on the beach.
speak, and it was wonderful. And I told people, it's not a conscious process. You know, it's something that comes from the affect, from the heart. Some people got this seed, some people got shell, some people got stone. And then we looked at each other's mandalas at the end of the process. And I think that's what's going on here. Because faced with the unknowing, faced with the chaos, which is our relationship with God, and our relationship with God is a relationship with the unknowing. Because anything we say of God cannot be God. It's a fact. We say God is good, like Nelson Mandela. He's obviously got to be better than Nelson Mandela. Say God is beautiful, like Marilyn Monroe, then he's obviously going to be more beautiful than I. You see what I mean? Anything we say about God cannot be God, by definition. So because we're in this place of unknowing, hid divinity, mystical theology, we have to resort to these sort of mechanisms. Yeah? Jolly good. Just to say a little bit, almost used up all my time now, just to say very quickly about the life of John. I won't go too much about this. He was born on the feast of St. John the Baptist, 24th of June, in 1542. In a little village in Castile called Fontiveros. Fontiveros. Hi, it's him. Come to welcome us. And that's probably where he gets the name John from. Interesting enough, he was a child of a love match. Child of love. The Spain at the time was a highly stratified society, extremely stratified, class-ridden society, we'd call it. You knew your place. There's a film called Chocolat. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful line at the end. It says that everyone knows their place, and if you forget, there's plenty of people around to tell you. That's Spain in the 16th century. If you forget your place, there are going to be plenty of people to keep you in your place. His father was from a wealthy family of silk merchants from Toledo, Ypez, Y-E-P-E-S. And Gonzalo de Ypez met his mother, Catalina Alvarez, when he was on a visit to Medina del Campo in Castile. Catalina was from a poor family. Perhaps I think I read the other day that I think she may have been an orphan herself. She was a small lady, a fiery lady. Again, some of the commentators speculate that she had Muslim ancestry herself. We'll hear a little bit more about her later. She plays an extremely important role in John's life in many ways. When they got married, or when they got together in 1529, John's father's family immediately disowned them. He refused to have anything to do because he's married beneath him, married for love. This made life very difficult for them, and in fact John's father died when he was 3 years old. Catalina went to the family in Toledo and other places and asked for alms for the family, and they all refused to give them anything. So the family were brought up in great poverty. In fact, there were three boys, and one of them died in childhood, and people speculate that perhaps he died of malnutrition because there wasn't a lot of food. There were bad harvests. So it was a pretty tough upbringing. John himself, because he came from this background, not much was expected of him. He went to the orphanage school called the Catechism School. And this was for the poor kids, basically, for whom not much was expected. And here he was taught the trades that they were expected to do in life: carpentry, tailoring, bricklaying, and painting. So when we think of John as this rather ascetic, otherworldly saint, we must remember he was an extremely good bricklayer. And not only that, he enjoyed bricklaying. And sometimes, I mean, later on in life, when he had enough of the politics, the religious life, he would go and build a wall, or lay a patio or something. You know, he'd go and do a bit of hard manual work. And throughout his writings and life, he stresses the importance of manual work, extremely central for him. When he was a teenager, we're not sure whether he was 13 or 17, he found employment in the plague hospital of Medina, Nuestra Señora de la Concepción. I've got a photograph of that. This is an engraving that was done at the time of beatification in the 1850s. He was beatified quite late, 15 years after his death. And this is him as a young boy, teenager, in the plague hospital. Pretty awful place. Most of the men there had incurable. It was a hospital for people with incurable diseases. Many of them had syphilis, which had become one of the gold and wonderful things, potatoes and tomatoes that had come from the New World. Syphilis was also one of the things the conquistadores brought back. And so these poor gentlemen, imagine what the medical treatments would be like at that time, had to undergo this horrible death. And John, very early on, was exposed to this, and also we hear an extremely good pastor, extremely good at looking after the gentleman. We hear that he used to tell stories and sing songs to the patients. That's really lovely for these gentlemen. They see this fresh-faced boy who could sing songs to them and raise their spirits. And throughout his life, he retained this pastoral gift. He was always a gentle soul who knew how to console people in times of hardship. At the hospital, the owner, Don Alonso Alvarez, spotted that this young boy had quite a lot of talent. He paid for him to go to the newly founded Jesuit College of Medina. Between 1559 and 1563, he studied there metaphysics, rhetoric, grammar, Greek, Latin, and Spanish literature. And this gained important influence on him because it laid the foundations for his own writing. He loved the writing he received there. He loved the grammar. He loved in particular the poetry and classical literature. And this would come out in his own writings later on, you see. Don Alonso wanted John ordained so that he could serve as chaplain to the Concepcion. And it paid for him to go and study at the University of Salamanca. However, before he did this, he joined the Carmelite Convento of Santa Ana in Medina when he was 21 years old in 1563, taking his vows in 1564 and adopting the name Juan de Santo Matia, John Matthias. I won't go on about Carmelite orders. Again, a lot of you, I'm sure, are familiar with Julien, Teresa and some Carmelite order. Sufficient to say that the Carmelite order he joined at this time is what's called the Carmelites of the Ancient Servants or the Mitigated Rule. They weren't of the primitive rule of Our Lady Mount Carmel. But if you want to know more about that, perhaps